Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano. On today's program, you'll be hearing speeches I recorded in mid-February 2002 at an event at the University of California in Berkeley. The event was called 21st Century McCarthyism and the Rise of the Global Police State. First, you'll hear Diane Clements, Professor of American Diplomatic and International History in the History Department of UC Berkeley. And after her is Jennifer Terry, visiting associate professor in the Women's Study Department of the University of California at Berkeley. Diane Clements' speech is titled, For Whom the Bell Tolls, American Freedoms. Diane Clements.
The topic which I would perhaps like to focus on more than any other is presently what we now are facing as America, which has become indeed a global power and projects its power and wealth globally, or as Henry Kissinger finally restated what used to be the old Monroe Doctrine when the United States called itself a policeman of Latin America. Finally, he let it be known that indeed the U.S. had become global and was, in 1972, he said, policeman of the world. And as policeman of the world, the United States has certainly undertaken to respond to whatever it wants to, anywhere it wants to, whenever it wants to. In this case, September 11th, we had, however, a difference. It is the first time in American history that the U.S. has been directly attacked in such a magnitude and with a center of our urban population, the focus. The phase that we are in now, having concluded that it is a partly won war, is one of expanding the war. And of course, it looks now as if in the, quote, axis of evil, one of the evildoers is being singled out, perhaps Iraq, to feel the wrath of the United States in its search for terrorists abroad. The whole role of the executive, which has been expanding from the days of the Constitution until it has become something that the Founding Fathers would not even recognize, is expanding greatly with the use of this war. It's a wonderful war to make excuses for and to allow the initiation of all sorts of policies and behaviors that would not be tolerated at other times. George Bush's presidential order on November 13th of 2001 to establish military commissions is now the phase that I think we need to look at, or at least I'm going to look at this evening. I'm going to look at it as the example because it's the easiest one to focus on right now, and it's one that you will be seeing a great deal of in coming days, to see just how American freedoms are doing, American justice is holding up, and just what this may portend for the future. Certainly, the executive has undertaken to subsume many rights that belong to individuals, which have suddenly accrued to the executive branch and have lost our individual hands. Similarly, the Department of Justice has also accrued new powers that once belonged to the courts, or which we thought were left in the court to review certain types of activities. Those, too, have tended to move upward and sever themselves suspiciously from their place of origin in which they constitutionally formerly resided. The presidential order establishing military tribunals is one in which the president himself makes all of the decisions from the beginning to the end. He can try, or he will try, members of Al-Qaeda, persons who are subject to trial by military tribunal by his edict. And these include the categories of prisoners of war. They fall also to the category that is particularly touted today of unlawful combatants captured in Afghanistan and also captured elsewhere, illegal aliens in the United States, as well as legal aliens or permanent residents, provided those two categories somehow arouse the suspicion of the executive branch that they might be involved in terrorism, which is enough alone in and of itself to begin and to initiate a whole process which can terminate in detention, trial, and review of that person's trial by only the executive branch and no one else, having occurred in secret and no word of it being available. We have been assured so far that that applies only to persons who are non-U.S. citizens, as if somehow we should rest easy at night knowing it isn't us. But that is not so, for this order is written so with a stroke of a pen and a change of a few words, it could apply nationally to almost the entire nation. The presidential order, or the executive order, violates all of the categories of those listed in terms of their rights. In all of these cases, there are indeed rights that exist for all of the categories that the executive order covers. Most of them stem from international law and also are reinforced by national law, either legislative decrees or by rulings of the Supreme Court. The president has violated, in terms of this coming forth with this order, many of the rights of Americans in establishing this category. For example, once the president makes the decision that someone is either a member of Al-Qaeda or is somehow involved in an act of terrorism or is suspected of being involved or of aiding and abetting terrorism, then that person can be seized, put in jail, and tried by military tribunal on nothing but the word of the president. This obviously, in the first instance, is without any due process and is a trial procedure with a foregone conclusion and violates all of the original ideas of American justice. But it is, in fact, what is now in place. There is also the presumption, since George Bush has assured us, that the only people tried under this procedure will be foreigners, they will not be American citizens, that foreigners do not have any rights, is what he said, and therefore we need not concern ourselves with the fact that these people are the ones who are subjected to these tribunals, and you and I presumably are not, at least at this point. However, there's a failure here to realize a number of very fundamental things, and the fact that it has not entered the consciousness of our executive branch is of grave concern to us. There is the overlooking, first of all, of due process of the Fifth Amendment, in which any person cannot lose life or liberty without due process, and due process was set aside in the whole contrivance of the system in the first instant. So we have here, in this instance, the creation of the military tribunal, which is one that was not meant at all to handle the issues which the president says it is. This war has not been declared. It has, in fact, been backed by the Congress of the U.S. The Constitution does not call for war by congressional resolution. It calls for war by declaration. So we're walking on really very infirm constitutional ground here. And indeed, the executive is the one who is on very infirm constitutional ground, particularly arguing for all the rights believed to have accrued to the executive and being used presently on behalf of the executive. It is possible there will be a further and rather wide-ranging setting aside of the due processes, bases of the American legal system, and basically the American system of freedom and its guarantees. We have, in fact, in this whole process of a system that has now eliminated and set aside due process, a military presence of the United States through the executive branch and through his attorney general that is reaching deep into the hearts of Americans. Not only are they detained, and can they be detained in this system, they have become, as aliens, an entire class or group of people who, as a class or group, and that is alien, might at any moment be deemed to pose a threat and could, as a class, be gone after by the executive branch. They're also in the due process list are the unfair investigations and prosecutions without any warning or without any warrant, without telling anyone, your home or your privacy can be invaded. Right that you presently have or think you have to consult a lawyer in privacy should you be detained by the government is no longer a right which is respected and a right which is suspended, believed to be in the interests of fighting terrorism and in the ability of the executive, therefore, to make that assertion, can be and would be taken away from many of us at any moment under this formulation. We are in, I think, a period of danger because we have no reason to believe that the executive understands this. If, in fact, the executive does, we may be in greater danger because then deliberately the executive is setting aside our rights while at the same time we have pages and pages of statements assuring us that that will not happen to us, and yet it has happened to many among us. We have to conclude, I think, not only must we worry, but as the American Civil Liberties Union pointed out to the Congress of the U.S. and to the Senate, that we are fighting a war against terrorism, but there's a war being fought against us and against democracy, and that perhaps should take precedent. Thank you.
That was Diane Clemens. Next, Jennifer Terry speaks of media, the state, and academia.
Bush, the son's administration, and many who support it has made the issue of speaking out in support of freedom to dissent extremely important at this time. After all, what exactly are we being asked to fight for? What kind of world do you want to live in? This is the basic question that we must ask ourselves now that the government of this country and many of its supporting institutions and constituencies appear to be unified in a mobilization for long-term, semi-secret war on an ill-defined set of enemies, also known as foreigners. Since 9/11, I found myself asking this basic question, what kind of world do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a world where it's unsafe to speak out loud critically against elected officials and government agents, where it's unsafe to walk on city streets or ride in an airplane or drive on a country road or live in certain towns if your name sounds, quote, foreign, or if you appear to look, quote, un-American? A world where it would be unsafe to dissent, that is to stand up for a friend or even a stranger who's being harassed and intimidated for, say, wearing a headscarf. Where being properly patriotic means to submit to executive orders and to clam up even if you think your nation's leaders are making big global scale mistakes. When in order to seem like a righteous citizen, you must allow your grief to be appropriated into a war cry. Where the question of what kind of world do you want to live in is supplanted by the intransigent and violence-inspiring question of are you for us or against us? Now, with that preamble, I want to spend the time that I have left this evening to use this particular question, what kind of world do you or we want to live in, to address in particular some issues that pertain to the power circulating between media representations of the war on terror and the state that polices what images and stories will be circulated and which will be suppressed over the mass media. How do these matters, moreover, relate to attacks on freedom of expression on college campuses? Civil libertarians are famous for saying that there's no time more urgent to defend and protect civil liberties than during war. Why? Because if one is fighting for freedom, as U.S. administrations always claim to be when waging wars, then it is of supreme importance to participate in the exercise of the definition of that freedom, and that is to exercise that freedom itself. And in so doing, to ensure that free expression and civil respect for nonviolent dissent will be a top priority of the state. Let me just highlight for you what I think are some of the key issues that have come to light in the last few months that pertain to the matter and the urgency of insisting upon free expression on college campuses. And in each of these instances, the media plays a very serious role. In response to the dismissal of a number of professors for talking about unpopular topics, that tenure arose as an institution. In 1957, the United States Supreme Court wrote the following in making their ruling in Swayze versus New Hampshire, quote, "The essentiality of freedom in the community of American universities is almost self-evident. To impose any straitjacket upon the intellectual leaders in our colleges and universities would be to imperil the future of our nation. Teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study, and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, our civilization will stagnate and die." That was a statement in 1957. The importance of tenure reemerges as an issue not only because of certain economic interests in downsizing universities and creating pools of unprotected labor. In addition, there is the occasion of national crisis and international crisis that has been used to go after non-tenured professors and now even tenured professors. Let me give you a highlight of recent events. In early November, that is roughly a month after the bombing of Afghanistan began, there was a gray list, what I'd call a gray list, of university professors assembled by a group called the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, which was entitled Defending Civilizations, How Our Universities Are Failing America. And this is put together by a think tank that exists within the Beltway of Washington, D.C., which has been essentially founded by Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, and Senator Joseph Lieberman in 1995. They have contributed something close to $3.4 billion to colleges and universities last year, making it, quote, the largest private source of support for higher education. I take that quote from their website. In November, when they wrote this report, they documented 117 campus incidences of evidence of anti-Americanism. More than 40 professors were named, including the president of Wesleyan University, who suggested in an open letter that, quote, disparities and injustices in American society and the world can lead to hatred and violence. Another example listed in among the 117 was a Yale professor who was criticized for saying, quote, "It is from the desperate, angry, and bereaved that these suicide pilots came." There's a long list of as I said, 117 incidents that constitute what is essentially a gray list, if not yet a black list. The recommended solution to this problem would be to create the circumstances but whereby tenure in certain instances would be revoked. And in general, in some cases, done away with in general. Okay, another incident. Shortly after the beginning of the bombing in October, a tenured professor of communication and journalism at the University of Texas at Austin named Robert Jensen was reprimanded by his university president in the pages of the Houston papers for speaking out against the war. The press has a big hand in a lot of these situations. The case of Sami Al-Aryan is a very important case to consider in light of all of this. He's a tenured professor of computer science at the University of Southern Florida, a Palestinian man born in Yemen. He's been essentially fired from the university. His case is pending, but in the state of Florida, Jeb Bush, the governor, revamped the entire state board of trustees that governs the universities of Florida. And among those are many conservative members. I want to highlight the case of Sami Al-Aryan just briefly for you because it is really a precedent-setting case. Whereas Robert Jensen was reprimanded in words in the pages of the Houston paper, Sami Al-Aryan is being actually fired, or at least it seems so right now, according to the latest reports. What did he do? He has sponsored an Islamic student group on the campus of the University of Southern Florida. And back in the 80s, he was captured on videotape at a conference in Cleveland in which he was engaging in the rhetoric of Palestinian nationalism and used the term in Arabic, said the term death to Israel, and that has been translated and used as a smoking gun to why now, 10 years later, though he's done very little of that kind of rhetoric of late, is responsible in part for endangering the campus of the University of Southern Florida. Why is he endangering it? His mere presence causes a dangerous situation because Mike Fletcher of the Tampa Tribune, who is a journalist who several days after the Oklahoma City bombing occurred, got on the bandwagon to say it must have been an Arab that did it, and has since then targeted Al-Aryan and several of his relatives as culprits for un-American activities. That's back in 1995, regardless of the fact that Timothy McVeigh was convicted and subsequently executed for the crime. The guy, Mike Fletcher, is followed up by a more recent instance of shock jock behavior. Immediately after 9/11, Bill O'Reilly of the famous O'Reilly Factor on Fox Channel, the channel that brings you 24 hours of fascism daily, whereas CNN is half the news all the time, Fox is fascism all the time. Bill O'Reilly had Sami Al-Aryan on TV and essentially nailed him live by accusing him of essentially having a direct connection to 9/11. And Sami Al-Aryan did not have decent legal counsel to suggest that he shouldn't have been on that show. Immediately following that was Bubba the Love Sponge. I don't know if you've heard of this man. He's a shock jock that goes normally by the name of Todd Klemm, who has an R-rated radio station in Tampa, who fomented so much hatred against Al-Aryan that death threats were pouring into the university, and that's what endangers the university. It's the death threats, which are presumed to be easily dealt with by getting rid of Al-Aryan from the campus. Since 9/11, the role of university administrations has been in the news as either abetting and aiding terrorism by not cracking down sufficiently on foreign student visas that have expired. And the university has been a site for the dragnet of this kind of new kind of McCarthyism that we're engaged with talking about this evening. So university administrations have been targeted for FBI investigations, and I'm afraid that universities, many of them, are caving under this pressure. In other words, turning over records without the necessary need to do so, subjecting students to a whole series of surveillance mechanisms that are based upon last names that sound Arabic and other kinds of criteria that go along with the racial profiling that the FBI is doing, despite the fact that they say they're not. One more little vignette, and then I'll finish. And that is the situation of untenured faculty, including instructors, adjuncts, and assistant professors that I've become aware of in my capacity as a co-founder of the Professors for Peace, which has a pretty active listserv that sends out about 20 messages a day, much to the consternation of all the subscribers. Since I'm a moderator of that list, many people send material for me to post who are untenured adjunct or assistant professors to post under my name because they do not want their name attached to what it is they're sending. The kinds of things they're sending are news reports from the Hindu Times or from the Pakistani newspaper called Dawn. For reasons that I think are fully justified, they are afraid to have their names attached to these postings, even though they are internet-accessed public newspapers from other countries around the world. It is not coincidental that many of these people are not U.S. passport holders. They're in the country on visas, work visas, to teach as professors at our universities, and we are very lucky to have them. So I'm aware of the kind of micro-politics on a daily level of how this is being internalized by people within the university. Okay, finally, what I want to talk about very briefly is why tenure is good for students as well as professors. In bullet points, let me just say, free expression and civil dissent and debate are key to the educational experience and make students think critically and independently. Much as the left has been accused of being politically correct and policing speech, that is absolutely a false accusation in most instances. We have been involved in developing educational experiences that are interested in dissent, that are interested in all kinds of dissent for the sake of learning. What else is tenure good for, then? It allows more innovative courses to be offered. If you have the protection of tenure, you can teach things that are unusual and interesting and urgent. And unfortunately, what happens up to tenure is people get so damn terrified about getting tenure that they lose all their innovative abilities. So I really like to encourage the fact that after tenure, what one can actually do is come back to life. What else does tenure do? It allows for scholarship that challenges the taken-for-granted notions that need to be rethought or deconstructed. Not in every case, of course. With professionalization comes conservatism, and networks get entrenched, and styles of writing and styles of thinking get entrenched. But there is the possibility, with the freedom of academic thought protected, to challenge some of the taken-for-granted notions. What else does it do? In the classroom, it allows students to question authority and to have an active role in their own education, because they're dealing with a professor who has the protection to offer them an opportunity to become politically aware and to engender an environment in which not only is compassion and precision brought into play, regardless of one's passport, but there is a modeling of what one could imagine the unfashionable dissent to look like. Okay, finally, to return to the question, what kind of world do we want to live in? A world, I would say, that is attentive to the realignments that are happening globally and locally. That's one thing that has happened after 9/11. The realignments have been, from one point of view, been triumphantly granted to Bush the son and his constituencies, but I think we also ought to think about realignments on the left and in other kinds of movements for social justice. What is our opportunity here? What are we being accused of? To be quiet is to lose. And so I would say the realignment here is also one in which conversation and dissent should be engendered and allowed and worked through. The role of the university in advocating free expression and nonviolent conflict resolution here and abroad seems to be very important. And I think what we need to do is take stock of the fact that the media monopoly that presently is running most television, cable, and mainstream broadcast networks could be broken to some degree by turning our attention, where the resources are possible, to web feed news from elsewhere, including radio and television feed from other parts of the world. Okay, so I guess I'll just stop there, and thank you very much for your time.
You've just heard first Diane Clemens, Professor of American Diplomatic and International History in the History Department of the University of California, Berkeley, and then Jennifer Terry, Visiting Associate Professor in the Women's Studies Department of UC Berkeley. They spoke in mid-February 2002 at UC Berkeley. The event is called 21st Century McCarthyism and the Rise of the Global Police State. I'm Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.